And it's been blowing a gale out there this morning, hasn't it? Seems to have settled down a little bit now. But if I said to one of you, well, will you go out there and just grab that wind and tie it down? You'd look at me as though I was mad, wouldn't you? But this is the kind of terminology that the writer of Ecclesiastes uses. He uses this phrase a number of times. It's grasping for the wind. A futility. A hopeless exercise. You go out there and the wind's blowing like mad and it's all around you and you try and grab hold of it and you can't. It slips through your fingers like water through a sieve. You can't hold it. You can't grasp it. And the writer of Ecclesiastes says that's what trying to find the meaning of life is like. It's a futile exercise. It's like trying to grasp the wind. It just slips through your fingers. You can't get a hold on it. Life is vain. Life is futile. Life is empty. It's meaningless. It's a hopeless exercise to try and understand what the meaning of life is. And yet, at the same time, we feel innately that there must be a meaning to life. There must be a key to understanding life's purpose. And so the writer of Ecclesiastes sets himself this task. I set my heart, he says in chapter 1, verse 13, to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. I set myself to understand the meaning of life, to find the key that will unlock the door to an understanding of life's purpose. And in this lengthy quotation, as I described it to you last week, from chapter 1, verse 12 to chapter 12 and verse 7, someone puts themselves in Solomon's shoes and reasons in the way that they imagine Solomon would have reasoned concerning life and its purpose, life and its meaning. And as he does this in the passage that's before us, from chapter 1 and verse 12 through to chapter 3 and verse 15, that's what we're looking at this morning, he comes to the conclusion that there are four things which one might think would give the key to life, which don't. And the first area is perhaps the one that we would think would be most likely to explain and give life a purpose, and that is wisdom and knowledge. But this writer comes to the conclusion that wisdom and knowledge are not the key to life. Let me read two valid portions here from this passage before us. Chapter 1, verses 16 to 18, and then chapter 2, verses 12 through 17. The writer says, I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. In chapter 2 and verse 12, I turned myself to consider wisdom, madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king or who comes after the king? Only what he, that is, only what the king has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet myself perceived that the same event happens to them all. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As the fool. Therefore, I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Wisdom, he says, is not the key to life. Knowledge isn't the thing that will give purpose and meaning to your existence. You can be the greatest, the wisest man who has ever lived, and it's not going to help you in the end. You can be the most knowledgeable person who has ever walked the face of the earth, and in the end, it's not going to help you at all. The writer here is putting himself as though he's Solomon, a man acknowledged to have been the wisest man in the world. People came from distant lands to come and see Solomon's riches, but also to hear his wisdom, to hear what he had to say, to hear the wise thoughts that he could share, to come to understand more of the knowledge of this great man, this king in Jerusalem. But this man came to feel that understanding life was madness. It was grasping for the wind. It was unattainable. In fact, he says, in much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. There's another saying that a friend of mine used to use a lot, which is just left my mind. It'll come back to me at a time when I don't need it. There we go. Ignorance is bliss. 'Tis folly to be wise. The more you know, the more responsibility you have to act on that knowledge. The more wisdom you have, the more understanding you have of folly, and the more distressing it is. That's basically what he's saying here. In much wisdom is much grief. In the increase of knowledge is increasing sorrow. And in the end, what's the difference between the wise man and the fool? Yes, there is a difference between those things. Wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. Wisdom is much better than folly, certainly. He says a wise man's eyes are in his head. He understands things. He can perceive what's going to happen. He can make good choices as a result of that. And the fool, well, he walks in darkness. He gropes his way through life. He trips and stumbles and falls. But, he says, I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. To the wise man who walks through life with his eyes open, making good choices, making wise decisions, and the fool who stumbles and gropes his way through life, the same event happens to them all. What's that event? Well, how does a wise man die? As the fool. Death comes to both. In the end, the ultimate thing is the same. Both die. Children last week in Sunday school were learning about the rich man and Lazarus. That poor beggar at the gate of the rich man in his fabulous mansion. But in the end, both died. Both came to an end. But you see, the problem for this wise man here is that he doesn't really have spiritual wisdom. He may have heaps of earthly wisdom, but he doesn't see beyond death. And we'll come back to this a bit later on. He's looking at life here under the sun, here on earth. And that's as far as his vision allows him to see. So when he sees that the fool dies, as well as the wise man, both have the same end. What's the point in being wise? You end up in the same place, buried in a grave. That's it. Life is over. Finito. No more. Well, what's the point then? Why should I be wise? As it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. Why was I then more wise? I said in my heart, this also is vanity. It's pointless. No point striving for wisdom and knowledge. In the end, it's worthless. It's not going to do you any good. And along the way, it's just going to give you distress and frustration. So wisdom and knowledge, they're not the key to life. As much as we may have thought, well, wisdom, that must be it. That must be the way forward. No, says the writer of Ecclesiastes, that's not the solution to our great dilemma. We will not find purpose through wisdom and knowledge. So he moves on from this pursuit of wisdom and knowledge, and he says in verse 1 of chapter 2, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. I searched my heart how to gratify my flesh. He pursues pleasure. There's where we'll find meaning in life. Here's where we'll find purpose. The pursuit of pleasure. The pursuit of wealth and riches and enjoyment. That's where I'll find meaning in life, he says. Well, isn't that a reflection of today? He says, I'll search out for laughter and mirth. But laughter is madness. Mirth, what does it accomplish? All the partying in the world is not going to bring meaning to life. Any party animals here? How do you feel when the party's over? How are you when you get up the next morning? Grumpy and miserable after being up until all hours of the morning. It was great while it lasted. But when it was over, and you felt worse than you did before. Partying, it doesn't bring any fulfillment. It doesn't give meaning and purpose to life. Some of you have lived that way. You've lived for the weekend. You've lived for the drowning of your sorrows in alcohol. You've gone through the week working to earn enough money to party it away at the weekend. Did it bring meaning, purpose to your life? No. It was vanity. It was madness. What did it accomplish? Nothing whatsoever. So he says, I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom. Now that seems a contradiction, I know. What he's saying there is he's weighing all these things up. Wisdom there in the sense of taking things in a systematic way. He's tried his parties. He's tried his laughter and mirth. That's not worked. Now he's going to try wine. He'll check that off his list of things. Then he'll move on to something else. He's trying every different form of pleasure that he can think of. He's using wisdom. He's using reason. He's using a system. He's approaching this methodically as he comes to determine what is the purpose of life. Can pleasure bring purpose to what seemed like a meaningless life? And he tries his wine, and that doesn't work for him. He tries great works. He makes himself houses. He plants himself vineyards. He makes gardens and orchards, and he plants all kinds of fruit trees. He makes great wealth for himself, great riches, and he has all of these material possessions, and he's looked on as a great and wealthy man. Well, this is Solomon, isn't it? Rich, great wealth, people coming to see the wonderful palaces that he built, the wonderful vineyards that he planted, the great achievements that he accomplished. Did all of these things, made pools to irrigate these orchards that he's planted. He acquires male and female servants. He has all these great possessions. That's what will bring fulfillment. He'll be a rich man, a great man in that way. But all of that doesn't bring him pleasure. It doesn't bring purpose either. I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward for all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. He's tried all of these things. He's tried mirth and laughter. He's tried his parties. He's tried his wine. He's tried to drown his sorrows in alcohol. He's tried possessions and riches. He's tried music and the arts. He's got his choir together. He's got the special treasures of kings. Commentators think those probably refer to the great treasures of art that were then around. So he's got his Van Goghs and whoever the other famous artists are. He's got all of these things. He's got his wonderful art gallery. He's got his singers. Now, for some unknown reason, the New King James also says that he has his musical instruments of all kinds. Well, that's probably the worst of the possible translations of the text. It's a possible one. But if you've got the NIV, I think it says harem there, or concubines. You know, he's tried his riches, he's tried possessions, he's tried sex as well. That's what it's saying, Solomon. The man of many wives. He tried it all, you see. He tried every form of pleasure that there was. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them, he says. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. And my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward. For a time, it brought great pleasure. But pleasure, he says, is not the key to life. I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. In the end, these things didn't matter. They were there for a time, and then it was all over. It was gone. It didn't bring satisfaction. It didn't bring real meaning. It didn't bring a true sense of purpose to life. It was like grasping for wind, even in the midst of pleasure. Worthless, hopeless, vain. So he tries something else. Well, if pleasure won't work, maybe hard labor, hard work, that's going to be the key to life. And he says, in verse 18, I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled, and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom and knowledge and skill. Yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This is vanity and great evil. For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. Hard work, that will bring purpose to life. But he says, no, it doesn't. You work hard all your life. You have sleepless nights thinking about the next project, worrying about the decisions that have to be made. Where are you going to expand your business? where your next investment should be, which stocks you should sell and which ones you should now buy, you know, what's going down, what's going up, how you can further extend your influence and your standing in the world. Hard work. That doesn't do it. All of that, in the end, has to be left. Naked I came into the world, and naked I shall depart. This is what he understands. In the end, it gets passed on to someone else. And this man's great fear is that it will be someone who isn't really his choice. When he talks about it, another man having his labour, it's not the natural sort of inheritance from father to son. He's concerned that someone else, and perhaps for a king this is particularly likely, all the work that he's done in building up a kingdom, passed on to someone who won't appreciate it because they haven't worked for it themselves. And it's all vain. It's all worthless in the end. When I die, what benefit has it done me? None. What good is it? None. When I'm buried in a grave, in a gold-plated coffin, what good is it? None whatsoever. It's hopeless. It's worthless. It's vain. He says another thing in the midst of all of these, in his pursuit of wisdom, in his pursuit of pleasure, in his pursuit of meaningful life, in hard work. There's another thing that he's tried. Being the greatest. That will bring purpose. Being top dog. Reaching the top of the ladder. Being at the pinnacle of success. He's the greatest man with wisdom. He's the greatest man for wealth. I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. He pursued pleasure. And he was the greatest one of achieving all kinds of different things in that area as well. This was a man who had reached the top. But it hadn't brought meaning to his life. The rat race is vain. It's empty. It's devoid of anything really, truly worthwhile. And so, in the end, after weighing up these four different things, wisdom, is that the key to life? No. Pleasure, is that the key to life? No. Hard work, that must be the key to life? No. Being the greatest, being the best? No. And he concludes in the end, you know, the key to life is beyond man's grasp. And that's what he argues from verse 24 to verse 15. A part of this passage that we may initially think is quite positive. It seems to be pointing towards God and suggesting that after all, the pursuit of pleasure and wisdom and knowledge and hard work, there is something that brings meaning to life. But no, what he's actually saying is it's a hopeless case. Man cannot find the key to life. It's beyond him. It's impossible. There are a number of things in this passage that clearly indicate that this is the way that we ought to interpret it. He says a couple of times, nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink and that his soul should enjoy good in his labour. Says that in verse 24 of chapter 2, and he says it again in verse 12 of chapter 3. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labour. Now, this passage puzzled me for years because it didn't seem right. It seemed to be saying something was good, that this was it, that this was the answer to the frustration, And yet at the same time, the answer seemed to be based on something that elsewhere in the scriptures is frowned on. Let's eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Well, everywhere else in the scripture, that's condemned, isn't it? That kind of attitude. Eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And yet that's what he's saying here. He's concluded there's nothing better. Not that this is good, but there's nothing better. It's a frustrated sigh that's coming across him. There's nothing better, after all, than to eat, drink and be merry. Do good, yes, but he's not talking about good necessarily in a moral sense. He's saying, sort of do the best that you can. In the end, there's nothing better than that. Take what pleasure you can get out of life. Do the best that you can in life. You know, if you have an aptitude for wisdom, well, use wisdom. You know, don't pursue folly just for the sake of it. Do the best you can, but in the end, that's all you can do. You'll never find any true satisfaction. There'll never be any real purpose. You'll never find any lasting meaning in life. So just make the best of it. That's what he's saying here. I know he brings God into the picture, doesn't he? But look how he brings him into the picture. This also I saw was from the hand of God, there at the end of verse 24. The end of verse 13 of chapter 3. It is the gift of God. But what's he saying here? Well, I think part of the key to it is in chapter 1. In verse 13 he says, I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. This burdensome task, it could actually be translated, this evil task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised, by which they may be burdened, by which they may be frustrated. These things, the best that you can get out of life, eating and drinking, these things are from the hand of God. These things are the gift of God. But they come from God not to give us meaning and purpose, but to sort of frustrate us. God's playing with us, he's saying. God is simply playing with us. He's making sport with us. Like a cat playing with a mouse. Like the old cock fights. And the bull fights of Spain today. Just playing, toying. But what about that section full of wisdom? There's a time for everything. For everything, there's a season, a time for every purpose under heaven. And he lists these things. Perhaps he's quoting a recognized proverb, it's uncertain. Time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck what's planted, so on and so forth. And in verse 11 he says, God has made everything beautiful or everything acceptable in its time. Sounds good, doesn't it? Also, he goes on to say, he has put eternity in their hearts, that is, in the hearts of men. But all of these apparently good things are surrounded by messages of frustration. I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied, this burdensome task, this frustrating task. And he says, it's all a frustration. It's all vanity. How should we understand this? That there's a time for everything. Everything is beautiful, is acceptable in its time. That God has put eternity in the hearts of men. Well, what he's saying is that we innately have a sense that there is more to life than just the frivolous. That life oughtn't to be simply vanity and meaninglessness. We have this implicit understanding that there is more. He's given us this consciousness of something more to life than birth, a futile life, and death. birth, a futile life, and death, birth, a futile life, and death, over and over and over, generation after generation. We have this sense that there ought to be more. Why else has this writer spoken with himself, reasoned with himself, set his heart to seek and to search out wisdom concerning all that is done under the sun? Why? Because he knows that there must be something to it. There must be purpose. Mankind, unlike all the other creatures, is not satisfied with the status quo. We want more. We want to understand more. We strive after more. And God has done this. God has given us this consciousness. Yet, he says, frustration of frustrations, no one can find out the work of God. It cannot be done. There's a time for everything under the sun. Everything is beautiful in its time. God knows this, but we never know. There's a time to be born, but we have no control over that. There's a time to die. Well, we don't even have any control over that. We try to work out the times to plant and the times to reap, but how often do the storms spoil our crop before we've harvested? How often do our plantings come to nothing because we've missed the rains? There's a time to kill and a time to heal, but when is the right time? All these things that we have to try and guess at. And some of them we've come to understand more than others, certainly. But what the writer is saying is that ultimately it's all a frustrating work of guesswork, even in these things. And he goes on and says, I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it. That men should fear before him. And he's using that not in the sense of that men should reverence him, but that men should be fearful of him. He's saying God shows his power. He shows us who's in control. Not in an attempt to get us to trust him, to lean upon him, to grow to love him and worship him, but so that somehow God gets a kick out of seeing our frustration. This is the kind of attitude that this man has as he looks at his life. That which is has already been, and what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past, which is yet another one of the New King James's unfortunate translations. The idea is, God is going to bring about what has been in the past. It's going to happen again and again and again and again. It's what the narrator summarized in his introduction to this book. Life is just a series of meaningless repetition. This is it. This is life. And there's no meaning to be found in it. There's no key to life's purpose. We just have to do the best we can. Eat, drink, enjoy your labour. Do the best that you can. Because in the end, that's as much as we can do. But is it? Is that life? Is that all we can hope for in this world in which we live? Well, of course it's not. And the problem with this wise man of the world is that he fails to appreciate God's place in the world. He fails to understand God's purpose in the world. He focuses on himself. He says, what can I get out of life? What will make life fulfilling for me? Well, wisdom and knowledge. Once I've attained great wisdom and knowledge, I will feel satisfied with life. He gets there and he doesn't feel satisfied. Oh, I'll fill my life with pleasure. Once I'm saturated with pleasure, I'll be satisfied. But he's not. Tries work. And the same thing. It doesn't give him satisfaction. He focuses on what he can get out of life. And the key to life is to shift our focus from ourselves onto God. God is the center of our life, not us, not me. That's what the Ten Commandments teach. Ultimately, it's shifting focus from self to God and to others. But this man never thinks of others, does he? In fact, he gets quite disgruntled at the thought that someone else will inherit his wealth. He wants it. If he could, he'd take it to the grave with him. He doesn't want someone else to benefit from his labor. No way. But the Ten Commandments would teach us to love God and to love our neighbor as ourselves. To put God in the primary position and to put others before ourselves. But this isn't what the man in Ecclesiastes wants. He wants to find purpose and meaning in life for himself without reference to others and without reference to God. Where in reality, the only meaning and purpose in life can be found by putting God in the center and focusing all our attention on God, on serving God, on doing God's will. And this is what Paul refers to in Philippians 1, verse 21. For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. Well, the writer of Ecclesiastes never thought that death was a gain. For him, it was the ultimate vanity. To die and leave everything behind. For Paul, to die was gain. To go and be with God, gloriously free from sin. But while he lived, his focus was on Christ. When he lay in a prison cell, he sang praises to his Christ, his Saviour. When he was on a ship in a storm with death staring him in the face, he called others to look to God, his God, whom he served, and all would be well. When he travelled from place to place, from city to city, with beatings and scourgings and stonings and so forth, Christ was always there. He was doing it for Christ. For him to live was Christ. He didn't think, now what pleasure can I get out of this? He didn't think, what riches can I gain here? He didn't think, what wisdom and knowledge can I make to my advantage here? It was always Christ. How can I serve Christ here? How can I make Christ known in this situation? How can I be a better testimony to Jesus Christ under these circumstances? And so the writers of the Catechism, in their question, what is man's chief end, gave the answer, man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. Not to enjoy me forever, but to find enjoyment in serving and glorifying God. And indeed, we will only ever be able to truly glorify God when we are enjoying him. Enjoying all that he has given to us in this world, despite its being marred by sin. The key to life is found in putting God first rather than self first. And if this writer of Ecclesiastes had done that, his outlook would have been completely different. He wouldn't have seen God as a distant God who was playing games with him. But he would have seen God as a near God, as a God who blesses, a God who gives good gifts. And he would have used all of those things to glorify God and to call others to glorify God. But this man, he doesn't see that. Doesn't understand that. And in all his wisdom and knowledge, he cannot see beyond his own pleasure and finding fulfillment in his own life. Paul sets the pattern for us, not the writer to the Ecclesiastes. For me to live is Christ, to die is gain. Is that your testimony this morning? Do you want to live for Christ? In all the mundane routine of daily life, do you give thanks to God for all the good gifts he gives to you day by day? And do you constantly look for ways that you can glorify God, be thankful to God, serve God by serving others and praising him? Is this your hope, that at the end of your life you will stand before your Saviour and hear him say, "Well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of your Lord"? There is meaning. There alone is purpose.